No one really denies the importance of philosophy in the life of man. But in recent times, we have been brought to the unfortunate emergency of being forced to interpret a very large, good word in a way entirely contrary to the original insight which was associated with the term. We think now of philosophy as some kind of a formal instrument of thinking, and that this instrument some way lies outside of ourselves. We study philosophy, but it does not necessarily follow that we practice it or gain any direct insight as a result of the learning we accumulate. Thus, we may say that for the most part, what passes for philosophy today is a history of philosophic thought in the past and variously documented biographical sketches of earlier philosophers. When you read a story of philosophy today, you read principally an account of persons, not of ideas. And these ideas that they do have are associated directly with these persons. So we think of the philosophy of Hegel, and we call it Hegelianism. We think of the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas and call it Thomism. Thus, we have schools of philosophy, so-called, that arise from the thoughts of men. Perhaps it would seem that there is no other place they can arise. But human beings are very strongly individualized. And when Immanuel Kant gave his philosophy to the world, we associated it with his name. Of course, we cannot avoid this entirely. We think of Platonism, Pythagoreanism, Neoplatonism. These terms are always associated with persons. To a measure, we accept this. But actually, we are dealing with something that transcends persons. Plato and St. Thomas Aquinas were philosophers because of a certain capacity within themselves. They were not philosophers primarily because they were students of philosophy. They were brought to a high place in the intellectual life of the race by their own magnificent internal equipment. And through this equipment, something was released into manifestation. Today, in most lines of thinking, we believe in a more or less accumulative procedure, and medicine is an example of this. We no longer think of medicine primarily in the terms of doctors. And while medicine has its heroes, these are not the heroes we think of when we think of healing. We think of healing as a great body of knowledge, not merely a number of interesting individuals. Actually, the same is true of law. To the lawyer, there are many important legal personalities in the history of jurisprudence. But we think of law today as a great compound of knowledge given to us over thousands of years by persons known and unknown, named and unnamed, remembered and forgotten. We also have realized that law, as far as legal procedure is concerned, is more or less the result of the unfoldment of an archetypal entity of ethics within man, and that so long as man is ethical, this law operates, and his laws are ethical. When man fails in ethics, the law fails in ethics. It cannot be otherwise. Thus, through man, various truths come into manifestation, but these truths have an existence apart from man. And I think we should remember that philosophy is not something that is always captured by individuals, but that philosophy is some state or condition of the consciousness of living things, and that all creatures that have rational equipment at some time or other in the unfoldment of their natures pass through this phase which we call philosophical. We find that as maturity comes upon the individual in physical life, the certain changes come in his attitudes and his approach to life, that he begins to take on greater responsibilities, and that those interests which were sufficient for his childhood are no longer sufficient to dominate his activity. We do not think of maturity in terms merely of people who have grown up. We do not think particularly of Platonic maturity or Aristotelian maturity. We think of people growing up everywhere, in every walk of life, in every condition of consciousness. And I believe that in the course of time we must learn to approach philosophy this way, that we will no longer think of it as a traditional body of opinion, but we'll think about it as a living instrument available to each one of us. Truly, as in the case of most arts and sciences, we have to learn or study in order to become proficient in a form of knowledge. However, learning and study will not guarantee this proficiency. To all outside instruction must be added the internal factor of ability, or the individual must be recognized as having an aptitude for a kind of learning. It may well be that the musician will never have an aptitude for philosophy. Or it may well be that an actor will never have an aptitude for law or medicine. But it is very definitely true that all human beings have a certain degree of aptitude in the use of their minds. And philosophy, therefore, is a method of culturing the minds and thoughts of men. I think we must outgrow the idea that philosophy divides into these schools, and that we are only philosophical to the degree that we align ourselves with one of them. Just as today we may think ourselves religious because we belong to a certain church and doubt the religious integrity of another person because he belongs to a different church, today we have this same problem with philosophy. Those who follow the Kantian school of philosophy look with great suspicion upon the followers of Leibniz or the followers of other systems. They hardly speak the same language. So when we are thinking of philosophy today, we are thinking mostly of these great dominant systems of European intellectualism, which have dominated our way of life for many centuries. We are thinking in terms of allegiances to doctrines. And philosophy has become a vast and complicated doctrine, divided into innumerable sub-branches and divisions. These divisions being further divided and enriched by continuing contribution, so that even in this age in which philosophy is far from prevalent, we still have minor schools rising, such as, for example, our friends the existentialists. They constitute a philosophic group largely based in the philosophy of futility. This building of these schools causes us to say that philosophy comes to the person who spends a certain number of years studying the thinking of a certain person or school of persons who have lived at some past time and who have evolved within themselves a doctrinal structure relating to life and have interpreted universal existence according to a formula. If we accept this formula, we belong to their school. If we do not accept this formula, we are not welcome in that particular environment. So philosophy again becomes a selectivity among various formulas. If we find a formula that is rather pleasing to us, it is like finding a pair of shoes that somewhat fits. In this we feel a great achievement, a great victory. We are not likely to question as to why our favorite might have been wrong, or nor are we inclined to wonder why he didn't study other systems, which he never mentions, or if he was thoroughly aware of some of the systems that he denounces or criticizes. We somehow, therefore, come to think of this philosophy as an available mass of opinion or belief or conviction, not perhaps entirely amateurish, because it has passed through a series of processings through able minds, and we have confidence in the philosophy because we have confidence in the ability of the thinker who gave us that particular system. It's all authority, it's all tradition. Now, we are not attacking the validity of either of these, but I think it results in a situation that is not favorable for the development of a philosophic era. The first thing you have to have in modern philosophy is an exceptionally good memory. If you are able to remember the essential elements of a system, you can probably gradually work up to a PhD. This remembering of a system does help in some respects, but it gives us the victory of having remembered and having finally received our diploma proving and certifying that we have a good memory. We then promptly forget about the whole thing unless, by some chance, we decide to be a professor of philosophy. Under such conditions, we begin to teach that which we have learned, often adding nothing of ourselves, but simply parroting the original text. We go on and on and on, repeating the same words like the family parrot, with not much certainty that we understand what they mean, or have ever been able to vitalize them beyond the problem of tantalizing a classroom with difficult questions. This means that we go on through what we now call learning and can graduate with all honors and still have no dynamic within ourselves. Instead of philosophy creating within us a magnificent adventure, it ends up in a common boredom. If not worse, because if we start to study comparative philosophy, then we find that most of these intellects violently differed from each other, that many of them held utterly irreconcilable points of view, and that you can get into just as serious a dilemma trying to reconcile philosophic systems as you can trying to reconcile political or religious systems. Instead of the end being knowledge and wisdom and insight, the end of the search is confusion. We then come to the natural problem of the doubter. When the great masters of a learning cannot agree, what shall the humble followers do? They stand by in amazement, watching their betters, as Voltaire says, throwing three-legged stools at each other's heads. There seems to be no reason why we should expect more comfort from a philosophy than its principal exponents. And as very few of them seem to have gained any comfort, we can doubt the wisdom of the entire proceeding. This leads naturally to a skepticism. And when we learn that dozens of the world's great thinkers have startlingly disagreed, then we wonder what we can believe, what knowledge we can affirm. So that finally, as one the Greeks observed long ago, that the end of philosophical meditation is simply a legitimate doubt about the validity of anything. Philosophy producing the great skepticism, the sudden realization that all knowledge may be futility. So looking back over this problem and realizing that it is one of the heritages which we bring down into modern times, it seems well to try to analyze it a little more closely. And we have a splendid parallel in religion, which has been close to philosophy in many respects since the very beginning of time. We observe that in philosophy, as in religion, and more or less in science also, the tendency of the individual and of the school and of systems is to glorify points of difference. A system stands because it is isolated by its own ideas. A system has a reason to exist because it is different. The concept is, if it was like other things, it would be dissolved or absorbed by other things. If several different religious groups admitted their identity, they would have no longer any reason to struggle for their own existence. They could meld or mingle or merge, be one body, and the small, isolated struggle, which makes meaning for many of these people, would no longer be reasonable or profitable. The same is true in philosophy. It is assumed that these differences of opinion sharpen the wit, but more actually, I think they dull it, because they give us no solid core of integration. Actually, religion and philosophy have this in common. The division can occur within them, but that substantially they cannot be divided, either within themselves or, for that matter, from each other. Thus, philosophy is an inclusive, within which all types of philosophic thought have a common existence. All philosophy springs from one over concept. All philosophy unfolds according to certain obvious human phenomena. All philosophy has one practical use. All the differences and all the various divisions that arise within its schools simply represent a certain human competition. The fact that man seems to prefer to compete rather than to cooperate may play a part in this. Man believes that he is important to the degree that he is different. If the individual cannot be in some way unique, he is not an individual. And for most people, difference of opinion is the only valid uniqueness that they can understand. So in philosophy, schools exist simply because they differ. Without this difference, the great stream of philosophy would flow along. And many feel that under these conditions, it would flow along without actually building any monuments to itself in the world. That actually these monuments stand as markers of the victory of ideas over other ideas, whereas really they should stand for the unity of ideas that have arisen throughout the history of the world. Today we can no longer afford this luxury of endless argument and debate concerning something which most people today have concluded that nobody knows, and therefore that philosophy has become highly passé in the popular thinking, simply because the average person can find no use for it. He finds that there's absolutely no way in which he can go down to the grocery store and get a cut of meat cheaper because he quotes Aristotle. In fact, if he suspected of so much learning, they were probably to double the price on him. Or feel that he is so absent-minded, they can cheat him and he'll never even know it. There's an old Greek philosophy that said in a play that was written long ago, the time for treason is at hand. The gods sleep in philosophy. Now, for that basis, you can now go on and commit murder because they will not wake up in time to do anything about it. This kind of thinking has caused, more or less, people to feel that certainly in a stressful, pressure-ridden economic industrial era, philosophy is just too much of a luxury. Perhaps it is also a kind of a luxury that is also too much of a headache. And the combination is just too much. And unless the person is planning a career as an educator in philosophy, he is very likely to neglect the subject. And he feels that he can neglect it with impunity. It isn't going to mean anything to him one way or the other. The chances of his meeting a philosopher during his lifetime, very small. The chance of selling him anything, very much smaller. Consequently, why specialize the field? This attitude probably had its best correction in Western thinking in the time of the Neoplatonists of Alexandria. Perhaps among Western scholars, the Neoplatonists were among the first, certainly, and the strongest to point out that philosophy is not a doctrine at all. Philosophy is a way of conduct. Philosophy is a code of action. It has nothing to do with abstract speculation about infinities. True, a philosophy can speculate. But unless this speculation leads to vital motion, unless our thoughts impel us to do something, these thoughts are simply impotent. And philosophy has come to be regarded as impotent intellectualism. The philosopher, enriched by maybe 8 or 10 years of specialized schooling and study, stands like the common man in a daze in the presence of emergency. It hasn't touched him. It hasn't given him this inner strength with which to create a useful life. The Neoplatonists and some others among Western thinkers, including the Gnosis, took the attitude that, to a measure, science is a kind of food for the objective mind. Man taking science into his mind, working with it, comes out with electric toasters, automobiles, synthetic fabrics, hormones, and antihistamines. At least he comes out with something. And according to the label on all the packages, these medications are effective, except in approximately 1 case out of 100. And in that case, you may get side symptoms. These side symptoms may include anything from your hair falling out to dropping dead. But that means that you are not one of the 99 who will respond favorably to this particular medication. You are the black sheep, in other words. But when all kinds of ideas go into philosophy, and somebody spends many, many years learning to be a philosopher, what comes out? Well, perhaps it is fortunate that no histamines do come out. But what else comes out? Usually, absolutely nothing. The individual does not build better mousetraps. He does not do anything that seems to cause him to be admirable or venerated. About most you can expect of him is talk. And most of the talk does not make sense to anyone else, and sometimes we doubt if it does to him. So there is this lack of productivity. Now, there is something wrong in the system, or this would not happen. Because as science should lead the objective mind into creative self-expression. So philosophy should lead the subjective inner consciousness mind of the individual and cause it to manifest outwardly into his life as creative activity. In other words, a philosopher, because he is a philosopher, should be a person of action, who does things, who solves problems, who creates solutions, who leads various processes from confusion to order. Actually, your philosopher, like the philosopher king of Plato, is your ideal statesman. He is your ideal counselor, your ideal legislator. He is the ideal person behind nearly all forms of specialized knowledge. Yet today we have the specialized knowledge and nothing much in the form of philosophical insight behind it. And we have the specialist in philosophy whose vision seldom leads to new and useful improvements in our way of life. Thus, instead of awakening or arousing the psychic life of man, philosophy acts as an opiate upon it. It dulls it, puts it to sleep in abstraction, or creates for it a mysterious internal neurotic life of speculation and contemplation, an imaginary world into which the individual may flee to escape the pressures of factual circumstances which he does not wish to accept. In this type of keeping also, philosophy becomes the doctrine of evasions, by which the individual, with a little logic and less reason, is able to clear himself of all responsibility for his own conduct and to blame the world for all the misfortunes that occur to him. Thus, philosophy, in this way, is not much use to us in preparing a new way of life for our modern time. We can no longer simply build upon the academic systems of philosophy, any more than we can build firmly upon the creedal systems of theology, or again upon the complete scientific methods which are arising in this area of knowledge. We are not finding what we most need, and that is a moving force within ourselves to impel us, to direct us, to lead us in courses of right conduct. While it isn't always apparently convenient or the best thing to do to go back and discuss people, because we have tried in a sense to point out that we cannot confuse people with ideas. But we have to a measure, because history has done it to us. It has given us a vocabulary with limited words, and it has forced us to the use of simile and similitude in order to express our own meanings. So therefore, we can go back into philosophy in this sense. And while we cannot say that philosophy is identical with any philosopher, we can say to ourselves, what manner of person who has been a philosopher best exemplifies the fullest expression of philosophical method? In other words, what has philosophy most accomplished for those most accomplished persons who have accepted it as a way of life? Well, I think we have a good example of this type of insight in Socrates. Socrates was certainly not a pacific dreamer. He did not sit around dealing out abstractions to a few chosen patricians. First of all, Socrates had the reputation of annoying more people than anyone that ever lived in Athens. This was healthy, at least. He was out making himself felt as a force in the life of his people. Socrates also had a wonderful reputation for being a brave defender of his city. When the time came and the Greeks had to go out to war to protect their commonwealth, Socrates was in the front row of the army. When the enemy saw him there, they divided and went on each side of him. No one wanted to face this doughty soldier. Socrates was also a man of extraordinary self-discipline. For in part of his guard duty, it is said that he stood motionless, barefooted in the snow up to his knees for 24 hours. This is a pretty good test of something. In other words, this man had begun to discipline himself. We know that he was very clever in the argument and debate, that he was ruthless in his attack upon hypocrisy and subterfuge, and that he also was a person of such grave courage that he cheerfully and willingly chose death before the compromising of his convictions. Philosophy had done something for this man. Some will say this man did something for philosophy. Perhaps both may be true. But here we have a person to whom great learning gave not an impotence of character, but a tremendous impetus to power. This person used philosophy to create a great life for himself and left an imperishable heritage for those who came after him. Now we begin to think of philosophy as meaning. It suddenly has significance for us. And we check others of similar abilities and similar dedications. And we find that philosophy in its best form, in its living form, has always strengthened the individual against the uncertainties of his time, rooted him in reasonable and rational convictions, protected him from fanaticism, superstition, and fear, and overcome in him that other strange impotence which arises from ignorance. So philosophy becomes a nourishment or a food or a medicine for the infirmities of human character. It gives the person the power to put his own life in order. Well, this we need, and we need it as we never needed it before. We also realize that in every generation in which philosophy has arisen, philosophers were more or less solitary people. I don't think that there was ever an age in which the world agreed upon honoring philosophers. Some nations honored them more than others, but for the most part, they were solitary miracles of nature, arising in the most unlikely places and uncertain times, revealing their strength often against a background of extraordinary corruption. And gradually, their names and memories have come to be honored, although perhaps they were little known in their own time. So philosophy was not the result of a fortunate world. The great truths of life were not given to mankind in some blessed period when all was going well. They came at the most critical periods in the life of our people. Buddhism was brought to India in a period of great corruption in India, at a time when practically all values were falling apart. Christianity was given to the Near East at one of the most tragic periods in the life of the Syrian peoples, the period of their bondage to the Roman Empire, and still green in their memories the remembrance of the Babylonian captivity. Therefore, this period was not a period of great happiness. China received Confucius at a time when China's culture was at a dangerous degree of decadence. And Confucius fought all his life to find one honest prince who would establish the proper reforms for the state. These men all lived in difficult times. They were individuals who were strong in the midst of the weakness of those around them. They were not the products of Social Security or old age pensions. They were not the product of the policy of the four-hour day or the three-day week. They were not the products of extraordinary luxuries, of unusual opportunities. When most of these individuals lived and flourished, there was no such a thing as a public school. These individuals learned, perhaps from wandering or itinerant teachers, or because of their own abilities and peculiar powers, were apprenticed to some scholar or teacher for his instruction. These people were therefore products out of themselves. Leonardo da Vinci was not merely a diploma graduate from some other institution. He was a creative thinker in his own right. He arose, it is true, in a time in which there was great emphasis upon culture and cultural things, but most of the emphasis was bad. It was the emphasis of the court of the Borgias and the Medici. Leonardo rose as a great human being, and in his genius was apparently parentless and without forebear or even cultural sire. He was a tremendous force in himself. And this has been true of great philosophy wherever this mysterious power has revealed itself. It is not something that has been communicated from one person to another until it finally died of boredom. Philosophy has been a sudden flashing blaze of insight, breaking through the darkness from the inside of man, coming through into his exterior activity as a tremendous moral conditioning ethical force. This is what we are striving to reclaim or rediscover in our time. And we do have a great deal of ground upon which to build. But unfortunately, no one much is building on it. Other lines of thought have become the fads of the hour. And it is impossible to build a great system of ethics upon a fad. It has to be built upon a long, enduring concept of value. Everyone who is interested in comparative religion, mysticism, and related subjects is to a degree within the order of the philosophic field. Philosophy belongs to him. He belongs to its world. He is making a journey through life, and the only way this journey can be made adequately is with the aid of philosophy. So what are we going to do about it in our daily thinking? How are we going to start in our modern world to determine what is good in philosophy? I think we have several choices, but these choices are all of them based upon something that moves in us. Philosophy is not something which we can fully accept merely by acknowledging it mentally. We can say to ourselves, I have read 20 books on philosophy, and I think this is the best one. Therefore, this one I will now accept. And as a result of that, I would like to be known from this point on as a follower of that system. And regardless of what other people think or other people like, from now on, I'm a Cartesian. I am a follower of the philosophy of René Descartes. This is wonderful, but it dies there. If we are extremely literate, we might do a new book on Descartes, which means that we will pick out quotations from older books, put them together, and write a preface. Because actually, Descartes said himself what he wanted to say, but no one has been allowed to let it rest there. And there have probably been thousands of people who told Descartes, in the form of books, what he originally meant. And the chances are he would not recognize any of them. But this is what we do. But we are now a Cartesian. And we look around us to see what difference this has made in our lives, and we see no particular difference. We still have the same appetites for breakfast. We still have the same trouble with our neighbors and we are still rather unhappy in our employment. These things haven't changed. We get tired, worried, and frightened just as we did before we called ourselves Cartesians. So we have a new name for something. For what? Well, simply for a nominal allegiance. Some time ago, before the war, Japan was in a spot of this kind. It was beginning to develop a little international trade, and it wanted to do something to kind of build up good feeling with the principal markets. So it was brought before the Diet of Japan as to whether or not Japan would become a nominally Christian nation. Some Japanese got up and pointed out that there were nominally very few Christians in Japan, that this might present a slight problem. And the Oriental, with a naivete that was worthy of anything we can produce in this country, and that's pretty good, pointed out that it wasn't necessary for Japan to have any Christians in order to be nominally Christian. All you had to do was say what you are and keep on believing what you had always believed. It was very simple. The whole thing was purely, shall we say, an adjustment for the sake of import and export. It might be easier to trade, you see, with other people who didn't think you were a heathen. So here is how you get to be a nominal philosopher. You believe as you have always done, but you give it a new name. And as nobody else knows what it is either, you are suspected of being an outstanding example. This means that acceptance has become the key to the whole thing. But acceptance isn't anything. Acceptance is trying to hang something on the outside. Acceptance is trying to gain a new personality with a haircut. Acceptance has something to do with putting a new kind of an appearance on things, but leaving the substance of those things unchanged. And this is where philosophy has gotten a poor reputation for itself. Actually, we can study, but when we have read 25 books and we now wait in our own minds to see which one we're going to follow, or whether we're going to be followers of René Descartes or good old Bishop Berkeley and his tar water, the question that now arises is, which code of conduct do we expect to live by? This is a tricky question for most people, because they have a perfect, solid intention to live by the same code they've always lived by. But it will be nice to gain a little intellectual luster and a high polish, but it's not going to affect what they do to any marked degree. There is a belief, if you study it long enough, it may sink in, but most people don't live that long, so that it doesn't sink in. Actually, if you're going to work on it this way, if you're going to take a number of books and read them, or study a nice survey of philosophy and try to decide which is the most important, then there's only one way to do this. It's not by an acceptance by the mind. The question is, if you're quite still and quite quiet about the whole thing, which of these different things you have read creates the greatest sense of aliveness inside yourself? Which one of these things suddenly restores a little faith in human nature, makes you really impelled to take a new and more constructive view on life? When you can say to yourself, yes, this particular philosophy has given me something, for from now on I can no longer hate anyone, then, if it's true, then philosophy is beginning to operate. Or if an individual who has been rather fanatical and bigoted in many of his points of view says that he has found a philosophy that shows him that he was wrong, that he is admitting that he is wrong, and still more important, he has ceased doing that which he knows now is wrong, then philosophy has become a dynamic. Then philosophy is changing the person from inside himself. It has converted his consciousness, not his intellect. It has touched his emotions, by which he feels a new sense of value. It has given him a more rational group of sympathies about things, about persons, about ideas. If this has begun to operate in him, we know then what Plotinus meant when he said to the young man who came to him, "Make philosophy thy journey." Life is a journey. And this life journey is most important if it is a journey in philosophy to philosophy. If it is a journey toward greater enlightenment. If a philosophy enables you to suddenly say to yourself, "I am ignorant," then this philosophy is good. It is doing something. But if after reading all these philosophies you reject all that do not agree with yourself and say, "Well, there's one thing that's certain, dear old Bishop Berkeley agrees with me. He must have been right." If we take this attitude, we're totally lost again. So philosophy has to be something that awakens a sleeping respect for value within the person, so that having accepted it, he can no longer be the person that he was prior to this acceptance. That for him, truly, philosophy is a new birth in time. It is a dropping away of an old self. It is a metamorphosis. It is the caterpillar truly building its cocoon and then breaking forth again as the radiant moth. It is a reintegration of life around a dynamic that is valuable to us. Now, what is the primary dynamic in philosophy? Well, the great purpose of philosophy, which like all ultimate purposes transcends the capacity of any man in his present state of consciousness from achieving that purpose, but its great ultimate goal is that man shall know truth. That beyond everything else, the most important thing in the world is truth. That the truth of a thing is much more than the fact of a thing. We think we know the truth when we say that water runs downhill. This is a fact, but not a truth. A truth has to be much bigger than this. It is a fact that we have alternation of day and night, but this is not a truth. A truth is in reality and substance, the internal reality or validity of a thing. The truth about it is the fact about the principles upon which it operates. The truth about it is the true reason for itself, the cause of itself, the nature of itself, and the purpose of itself, all continued or considered together as one fact, superior over fact, about this thing. So truth means that man, as far as he is concerned, must know the origin of himself, his own purpose and reason for existence, and his own destiny. Man must know with absolute certainty what the power is that governs the world. He must know with certainty what the power is that governs himself. He must know what his own consciousness is, what his own intellect is. He must understand the dynamic forces and vitalities of the universe. He must have a clear vision of the eternal purpose of things. And all this must be correct. It must be above and beyond all dogma and all conflict. And it must transcend any opinionism, any selfish futility which may be in his own nature. Therefore, to achieve this state of truth, man must know. And this knowledge must be knowledge of things that are primary and not knowledge of things that are secondary. Secondary knowledge puts man into orbit now around the earth. Primary knowledge puts man's culture into orbit around the radiant center of reality. Until this happens, his culture is insecure. Therefore, truth has to do with the salvation of empires. Truth has to do with the eternities of human progress. Truth has to do with the facts of survival and the inevitability of values, which are entirely beyond scientific speculation. Truth has to do with the power of the individual to relax because of an absolute core of certainty within himself, which is indestructible. Truth has to do with man's continuing unfoldment of ethics, his fairness, his vitality to good, his absolute dedication to principle above profit. These things have to do with truth, and on that basis, truth is very deficient in our modern world. Pilate asked, "What is truth?" And Jesus was silent. Yet it is the problem of philosophy to search for this truth and to realize that the search for truth is the primary end of life. Therefore, Plotinus says, make philosophy your journey. And this philosophy, as Plotinus also said, is that mysterious journey of the alone to that which is forever alone. It is a journey within ourselves which leads from the uncertainty of ignorance to the certainty and benevolence of total understanding. Now, it would seem that such things would be interesting. We know that an individual who gains great distinction in music is applauded and very often listened to in rapture by persons who really do not understand too much about music, but whose hearts sing when it is well performed. We know that people are interested and profoundly influenced by the skill of the scientist or the skill in any area of daring and courage. We applaud these things. Why, then, do we have no place in our way of life to applaud this journey toward insight? Why do we not actually recognize that the greatest of all persons, most worthy of our respect, is that person who makes this journey? And that the journey itself is the supreme profession to which life should be dedicated. Now, this journey in and toward truth is, by the very nature of our way of life, not a journey in the sense of a complete separation of man from one form of knowledge in the quest of another. Philosophy does not say to the man, you cannot be a mathematician anymore, you cannot be an astronomer, you cannot be a lawyer, or you cannot buy and sell merchandise. Philosophy says no such thing. Philosophy rather says that in all of these activities and outlets normal to man are to be found the essential elements of the philosophic life itself. Philosophy is not the result of turning from the world and seeking the values of aloneness. Philosophy is an alonely search because it represents an individual moving from a very strong interior motive through a world that does not understand this motive or appreciate it. But actually, to be the true philosopher, the individual must be universally informed. There is no philosophical maturity that can result from bigotry or from prejudice or from the restriction and limitation of interests. The individual who lives most becomes wisest. There is no great virtue in escaping life. The virtue is to move through life, accepting it on its various levels according to its true worth, and then moving through these experiences into the maturity of the power to experience within ourselves. So philosophy becomes actually of the principal teacher by which the purposes of life are integrated or organized so that we no longer live in a universal accident. We no longer struggle on in a cosmic dilemma. We are no longer convinced that we are going nowhere at several thousand miles a minute. We suddenly find that philosophy takes the world, the universe, and everything in it, and gradually begins the process of organization. It makes this world acceptable to the thoughtful person because he has endowed this world with the power of his own thoughtfulness. But he is trained, he is wise, he is scholarly. Therefore, he is not going to be foolish in his thoughtfulness. Now, this begins another very important thing. Philosophy, it is said, begins in thoughtfulness. Now, how do we get to be thoughtful? Well, we can listen to all the commentators, particularly on the radio and television. By means of this, we will guarantee that no one will be thoughtful. We can also read all the opinions of the learned. The latest books on all the subjects of international and national intrigue. We can keep on our quiet little problem of hating everyone we do not know and being suspicious of everyone that we do know. But this does not add anything to thoughtfulness. Thoughtfulness is a process of thinking. How do we learn to think? We don't have to. Man was created with the power to think. The only thing we have to do is to give this power a chance. So if the individual does not think badly, he will think right. So it isn't necessary for him to know what is right in order to think. It is only necessary for him to discover what is not right and stop doing it. If he will follow this very simple rule, he will soon begin thinking straight. Because he will always think straight if he doesn't put an obstacle in his own way. If he insists, however, on building a crooked path and walking in it, then he will not think straight. But his own thought has as its natural inclination to think with the universal mind. There is a power that rules and regulates the mental energy of the universe. And the natural process of this mental energy is to be intelligent. Therefore, you have to settle down to the slow and careful process of gradually indoctrinating intelligence out of this thought process. What we are really doing is taking long postgraduate courses in how to be ignorant. And when we have prevented ourselves from having a natural thought, then we graduate with honor.